This time on Vet Story.
Why would a guy, a 67-year-old ex-Vietnam helicopter pilot, be solo rowing the entire length of the Mississippi? It was the toughest mission, believe me, that I had during that war. I would have much rather flown into a hot LZ than have to do anything like that again. It makes you sit up straight in your chair.
That's the sound of canoe paddles moving through the water of the Mississippi River. It's also the sound of dedication. The dedication of Chief Warrant Officer Jim Krigler, a Vietnam veteran who is paddling a canoe down the entire length of the Mississippi River. After reading about Jim's quest on his website, I called the number I saw and left a message. And I was amazed. A few hours later, he called me back from inside the canoe. We talked for a few minutes, and we decided to schedule a time we could chat the next day. So the following interview was recorded while I sat in a comfy chair, and he was in a canoe paddling the entire time. All right, sir, I've interviewed people in their car. I've interviewed people at ball games. I think I did an interview once on an airplane. I've never, ever interviewed someone who was paddling, much less paddling the entire length of the Mississippi River. But Jim Krigler, how are you today?
Oh, I'm pretty good. I feel good. It's a nice day. The water's flat. There's just a little bit of wind, as you can probably hear it in my microphone. I'm averaging about 6.5 miles an hour. And you know, where I go, I mean, you can do about 40 or 50 miles in a good day doing that. That's about what I'm doing. I've already done about 35 miles today. And I got just a few more to go. I'm going to make it a 40-mile day.
All right, Chief. That sounds good. Now, you know what I'm going to lead with? The biggest question of the day, the question everyone asks you. So go ahead and let's talk about why.
Why would a guy, a 67-year-old ex-Vietnam helicopter pilot, be solo rowing the entire length of the Mississippi? It's a crazy, audacious act. And, you know, I have to tell you, I have to be honest with you, Phil, it wasn't on my bucket list of things to do. It wasn't up there with climbing Mount Kilimanjaro and all that stuff. But I'll tell you something.
Yeah, please do.
In May, well, it's May of this year, 45 years ago this month, I had the honor and the burden of escorting my roommate, escorting his body back to his family from a crash site in Vietnam. He was killed in action. His name was First Lieutenant Thomas Francis Shaw. He was from Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. And Tom and I had a handshake agreement that if one of us was killed in action, that the other would do everything they could to escort the body back and comfort the family. And 45 years ago was the first time I met a Vietnam Gold Star family. And it was the toughest mission, believe me, that I had during that war. I would have much rather flown into a hot LZ than have to do anything like that again. But it wasn't nearly as tough as it was on the Shaw family. I mean, their sacrifice was immense.
Mm.
40 years later, 40 years after I met that family, they tracked me down. That was about 5 years ago. They wanted to reunite with me, and they wanted me to speak at an event that they had, which I did. But that caused me to get involved with other Gold Star families. And since that time, Phil, I've spoken to hundreds of Vietnam Gold Star families. And one of the things that I've found is that the story is almost always the same. You know, they got a knock on the door or a devastating telegram advising them that their son, their loved one, was killed in action. About a week later, they got a coffin and a neatly folded American flag. They buried their son, and then because of the controversial nature of the war, no one ever talked about it again. And to me, I'm sure that's not every Vietnam Gold Star family, but it's many of the ones that I've spoken to. And to me, Phil, that's just not the honor that those families deserve. And so the reason I'm going down this river is I want to start a movement in America. I would like normal American citizens, just a normal American citizen, Sam or Joe Smith next door, to look up a Gold Star family in their community, any Gold Star family, get a piece of paper and an envelope and a 49-cent stamp, and write them a thank you note, thanking them for that sacrifice, or call them on the phone, or get their email address and email them. It doesn't have to be much. But as Americans, it's got to be something. And so that's the main reason I'm going down the river. In fact, I'll tell you something. I thought about calling my senator from this canoe and asking him to put a proposal in place that we make the day before Memorial Day Gold Star Family Day. Memorial Day, we honor those people that have died in service to our country.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the sword that slays the warrior remains in the heart of those that are left behind. And those families have to live with that hole in their heart. And I want to honor them more than what they've been honored. So that's the number one purpose that I have. I'm also raising money for a charity that honors those families. It's called American Huey 369. It's in Peru, Indiana. It's a group of wonderful patriots that's acquired some Huey helicopters. We have three very flyable, actually flew in combat in Vietnam, helicopters, Hueys. And we will give Gold Star families honor flights on those Hueys. And I'll tell you something. In Vietnam, Phil, the sound of those, everybody knows the sound of a Huey blade, those wop, wop, wop.
Right,
blades.
Right.
And, you know, in Vietnam, for our troops, it was a sound of hope. Because we were coming to get you out of there, or bring you ammunition, or take the wounded back. But today, that same sound of those blades is really more the sound of honor and the sound of healing. And if you could see these families when they get out of that ship, and we take a photograph of them in front of a helicopter every time they go on a flight. I mean, if you could see their faces and talk to them, they're finally seeing honor for the great tragedy and the sacrifice that their family has gone through. And so that's why I'm so passionate about raising money. Your listeners can go to my website. It's called missionofhonor.org. They can go to my website, and it's all there. I also wrote a book, Phil, called Mission of Honor.
Yeah, I was going to ask you to get into that next. Tell me a little bit about your book, because a lot of this motivation was probably born in the research and the effort you put into making the book.
I'll tell you what, a couple of, six or seven years ago, a couple of my grandsons were reading, had to do some books reports on Vietnam, and they discovered that helicopter pilots were in every battle. And they asked me to write some stories and maybe even write a book. And so I tried, but honestly, you know, for me, I'm the typical Vietnam veteran. I came back from that war, was chastised by America, and I said, the hell with it. I got my college degree from the GI Bill, and I went about my life, and I made a life better than most of my non-Vietnam peers, okay, as did most Vietnam veterans. So I put all that stuff behind me. And when my grandkids asked me to write about it, I had a great deal of difficulty until my wonderful 80-something-year-old mother sent me every letter that I had written her in Vietnam.
Oh, wow.
All 12 or 14 of them. It wasn't a whole bunch of them. But I had an opportunity to read my words from 40 years prior. And the first letter that I opened up was dated about 2 or 3 months after I came back. I was kind of curious why that letter was in that stack. And so when I opened the letter up and read it, it was a suicide note that I had written to my mother after I came back.
Oh, God bless.
And I have to tell you, when you read your own suicide note, it makes you sit up straight in your chair, okay?
Mm.
And I was more interested, you know, it's kind of like a Vietnam, for most guys, it's kind of like a little mosquito buzzing around, you know? You got to take care of it. You got to get rid of it. And so for me, writing that book was all about, you know, getting rid of that, doing something cathartic. I wanted to tell the story of a real American hero which was my roommate, First Lieutenant Shaw. I mean, I'm not the hero. I was just a helicopter pilot that wanted to survive the war,
sure,
like everybody. You know, in flight school, they told us there's bold pilots and there's old pilots, but there are no old, bold pilots. So my mission was just to be a good pilot, be as good a pilot as I could, and do my best and get back alive. That's what I wanted to do. That's what the book's about, okay?
Mm.
So there's also a message for America in there. You know, I'm not going to tell you what my moral dilemma was. You have to buy the book for that. But I had a moral dilemma. You know, when you're 16 years old and you make mistakes, you know, you like wreck your dad's car or something like that. But when you're 20 years old, which I was, you make some really doo-doos, really big ones. And I had a moral dilemma at the time. And I was at a crossroads in my life, and I didn't know which way to go, how to make a decision. I had really nobody to help me do that until I met my roommate. And my roommate, after he heard about my moral dilemma, he shared with me his compass of life and how he makes decisions on, you know, what to do. And, you know, because let's face it, Phil, I mean, even today, all of us, throughout our entire lives, you're going to come to a crossroad. You're going to come to a fork in the road, and you're going to have to make a decision. And usually, the easy fork to take is not the right decision. The right decision is usually the more difficult decision. And so my roommate gave me a compass, his moral compass, on how to solve those problems. And I am forever grateful for him for doing that. And I share that moral compass with people in the book. Because I think, as America, you know, we kind of lost our way a little bit. I think we need a little moral compass, maybe even in Washington, D.C. So anyway, that's why I wrote the book.
Outstanding. Again, the book is called Mission of Honor, and you can find it at Amazon. You can get a link to it if you go to your website, which is missionofhonor.org. I can't wait to actually sink my teeth into it. Normally, I try to read through the entire book before I do the interview, but, you know, I knew you were paddling down the Mississippi. I had to catch you while you were still in the boat. And
I've got almost 1,100. Look, I got 1,094 miles under my belt. So maybe by today I hit the halfway point. The halfway point's 1,125 miles.
Now, talk to me a little bit about the journey as you've had it so far. You started in Minnesota, a state where my family's actually from, so good on you for being a Minnesotan, eh? And you started in Minnesota back in April of 2017. Talk to me about whereabouts you are now, sure. How long it took you to get where you are today.
Well, I've been going a little over a month and 2 days. And I started on Earth Day, April 22nd. And I got out to the headwaters at Lake Itasca with my muck boots on, and I literally walked across the river. And when I got there, the VFW Honor Guard from Bemidji was there. They didn't tell me they were going to be there, but the sun was rising, and those stars and stripes and the VFW flag was there, and they really gave me a good send-off. They did not tell me they were going to do that, but there's a guy named Bruce Malrude up there who's the commander of the VFW, and he made sure that I had a good send-off. And, you know, the water's on, you know, that creek, it's just a creek up there. It's only 15, 20 feet wide, if it's even that wide, and it's probably 6 inches deep.
Yeah, little-known fact, for those that have never been to Minnesota, I've actually been to the headwaters myself with my parents, and it's amazing. The Mississippi, we think, is this mighty, wide, fast, swift river, but it begins as almost like a creek. I mean, in northern part of Minnesota, it's, yeah, you can walk right across it.
And there's actually trout in that river, which surprised me. Yeah, I paddled. The first day was about 60 degrees, and I set up my tent, and I woke up the next morning with an inch and a half of ice and snow on my tent.
Oh, no.
And paddled the entire second day in the snow. And it was a beautiful snow. There was no wind. It was like being in church all day. It was totally quiet, beautiful wildlife up there, birds, geese, just anything you can imagine. It was just gorgeous.
So just as we get to the part of the interview where we're talking about the spiritual, quiet,
peaceful nature of this journey, we get interrupted, and it's kind of ironic.
You're seeing wildlife. You're in kind of untouched coastline, although I can hear a train in the background, so you must be near the coast right now.
There's train tracks all along the river, and when they come to a crossing, which there's one coming up, they have to blow their horns. But, yeah, I've been going past trains for about the last 500 miles.
It was just after the noise of the train kind of faded off into the background that he shared with me something that was really telling. It showed the depth of the spiritual side of this journey for him.
You know, you're out here on the water, it's just you and your maker, buddy. You know, there's nobody else out here. And I bet I've only seen 5 or 6 pleasure boats in 1,000 miles, and only one other canoe. I've probably seen about 10 or 20 tugboats. Of course, this is their river. The further you get down the river, the more you're going to see more tugs. But, it's a good time to, I'm not a really overly religious guy, but honestly, you know, when you're alone, I mean, you know, I talk to my higher power. And I think you got to trust, you got to trust in your higher power. That's actually part of the moral compass, is you got to trust in your God. You got to make tough decisions and then deal with it. And anyway, I'm not sure if I'm answering your question or if I'm just paddling.
No, and you know what, Jim, this is what's going to be a pleasure about talking to you a few times on this journey, is that I will be able to just share this moment with you. Talk to me a little bit about your rig, this canoe you're using. I mean, I envision canoe at first, you know, and I see, the two-sided paddle that my grandfather used to have and, rowing on each side. Talk to me about the kind of mechanisms you're using on your canoe to make good time.
Sure. Well, the boat I'm in now is a Winona canoe. It's a Kevlar canoe. It's called a Minnesota 2. It's 18 and a half feet long. And it has no seats in it and no thwart, no carrying thwart. It's a totally blank canoe. And what I have in it, I put what's called an easy row. It's spelled E-Z-R-O-W. And it's a forward-facing rowing system. That's where you hear my paddles hitting in the water. It's a forward-facing rowing system. And I can go about twice as fast in this rowing canoe, forward-facing rowing canoe, as I can in my solo. This boat is very stable, and if you can imagine what it's like, now let me just talk to you about being an old guy and doing this. I'm getting in pretty good shape for my age.
Oh, that was my next question. Please tell me your age, because you are really an inspiration to me now personally.
Yeah, well, I'm 67. And my birthday is February 2nd, 1950. So imagine you're at the gym and you're on a rowing machine for 5 or 6 hours without stopping. So
wow.
That's what I do every day. This rowing system is actually made out of a Concept 2 rowing machine.
Hmm.
So the seat I sit on is a sliding seat. It's just like it would be in the gym. And so I slide back and forth. I use my legs and my stomach and my back and my shoulders and my arms. It's kind of a total workout. And I'm, after doing it for a month, I'm getting in pretty good shape. So
I can imagine.
I lost about 10 pounds, but you're probably burning. I'm just going to guess I'm burning an extra 2,500 or 3,500 calories per day than I would normally burn, so you almost can't eat enough to, keep yourself going.
Now,
in fact, I was eating a little energy bar when you called me. I usually eat a bar or some snack once an hour, and I force myself to drink fluids so I stay hydrated. So, it's important, but honestly, I'll tell you that. Just doing all this has cured a lot of aches and pains. As you get old, you stop doing stuff, and you get kind of, crotchety.
Oh, sure, sure. No, I mean...
Things don't move as well, but as you're rowing, you're using almost every part of your body. Not the only part that, for me, not the only part that's difficult is, after 5 or 6 hours of sitting and sliding back and forth, your lower posterior sometimes screams for a little mercy. So
your lower posterior. Seven, I love it.
Yes, your ass, basically. So 7 or 8 hours would be probably the maximum that I could do this. But once I get below St. Louis, that current, right now, that current at flood stage is probably 10 miles an hour in the main channel, maybe even more. I can do 13 to 15 miles an hour. You only got to go out there for 5 or 6 hours, and you're going a long way.
I'm curious about the logistics of each day. So when you're done and, you've logged your 5 hours, you think you've made decent time, do you just look for a nice spot to pull over, or is this kind of mapped out with some strategic thought so you know exactly port you're going to pull into?
Yeah, that's a good question. I have a Corps of Engineers river map, which shows every public boat access on the river. And, since I've got such a odd piece of gear, I can't just pull it out on the railroad tracks and, or on a dike. Mm-hmm. So I have to have a boat access to get my boat out. Now, I have about a week, maybe 10 days after I started, a guy that I flew Huey's with, and another roommate of mine while I was in the Army, his name is Herb Koenig. Herb's retired. He's 70 years old. And, the guy felt sorry for me sleeping in a tent in the snow because that's where I was sleeping, in a tent. So he drove his pickup truck and his camper 1,200 miles from Dallas up to, where'd he find me? Somewhere in north of Brainerd, Minnesota.
Okay.
And he caught up with me and he said, no, you're not going to sleep in a tent. He says, I'm going to be your ground crew. So every day we take a look at our map and we figure out where there's a good out and figure out how many miles it's going to be. Some days it's 30, some days it's 50, some days it's something different, 40 or something like that. And of course, it also depends on the winds. I mean, today is a nice day, but boy, I tell you, Phil, I've had some hellacious days with winds. You get a 25 mile an hour headwind and you're battling it all day. Those are the days I go to sleep at 7:30 or 8 o'clock at night.
I can imagine. I mean, it's an audacious time to be doing.
So this is pretty interesting. As we get ready to conclude the interview, he just kind of tells me out of nowhere that before he started his journey, he went to a Catholic church and he asked a priest to bless his trip.
And then this priest, this Father John, pulled out a medal, a travel medal that he gave me. And he said one of the most glorious travel prayers I've ever heard in my life. Hmm. And what he said was that my brothers that were killed in Vietnam, the men that I knew, he said that they're angels and that you'll have one in front of your boat, one on either side, and an archangel in the back. And he said, you don't have a thing to worry about because you'll be protected. And so I have never once questioned the fact that those guys are with me right now.
I was moved when he told me that. And you have to be moved or inspired to know he's gone 1,000 miles in a canoe. And although he's got more than 1,000 more to go, he never loses sight of the singular reason that drives this whole trip.
And frankly, Phil, there's a lot of people in this country that don't even know what a Gold Star family is. I want to change all that. I'd like to, like I said, I want to start a movement a little bit and just make some waves out here on the river. And I'm going to keep getting the word out. So I really appreciate you reaching out to me and helping me do that.
That's Chief Warrant Officer Jim Krigler. While his waves may only be made on the Mississippi, the impact for Gold Star families will be felt from coast to coast. I'm Phil Briggs, and that's Vet Story. For more on this story and others like it, check us out at connectingvets.com.